Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. My novel Insatiable, which is one of Waterstone's best books of 2021 and one of Apple's best audiobooks of 2021, is now available to pre-order in paperback from Waterstones. The special edition has bonus content and, hooray, sprayed edges, or spredges, as the cool kids put it. Waterstones also have exclusive signed copies of my new novel Careering, which is coming in March. Stylist and Good Housekeeping have both picked it as one of their top novels for 2022. It's available for Your Book listeners to pre-order from waterstones.com. Now on to today's guest, Sophia Money-Coutts. Sophia is a journalist, the author of fabulous romantic comedies, and one of my favourite people on the internet. We spent the afternoon in front of the fire with Sophia, eating French fences and talking about P.G. Wodehouse, Sarah Waters and her author parents. And we perused her spectacular collection of vintage Mills and Boone. Listen out for a surprise. We have a visit from a special guest who comes in at the end to join the fun. I want to start by asking you about a book, and this is a book that I have no excuse for not having read yet, and okay. I've not read it yet, and I really, really want to do it, but I'm quite scared of it. Can you guess what I'm going to say?
I can't tell what you're looking at. Is it Hamlet?
It's Hamlet.
It's Hamlet. I didn't read it for ages as well, because I think I was worried that I don't know Hamlet. I have seen Hamlet on stage before. Like, I think I went maybe at school, and I didn't understand very much of it. So I think a lot of people have been... Probably, I spoke to someone else actually about this, about Hamlet, and they said they'd been put off because they didn't know very much about Hamlet. And actually, then you read it, and I still know nothing about Hamlet, really. apart from, you know, that famous the skull scene, whoever, like Benedict Cumberbatch holding up the skull whenever he did it, if he did it. But I read it, and actually what it is, it's more a book about grief, and actually it's, well, a novel about grief, and it's one of the most amazing novels about grief I think I've read, like a mother's grief, basically. Do you know any of the story?
No.
It's basically inspired by Shakespeare's son, who was called Hamlet, I think. Am I going to get this wrong now? So, yeah, Hamlet, who died when he was 11. And Maggie O'Farrell has taken that and written the most beautiful account of a mother's grief. And actually what's clever, I didn't even notice it, I think it might have been a more clever friend of mine, who pointed out at the end, Shakespeare's actually never mentioned by name. Oh, I think it's him the whole way through. I don't think you even get Will or William.
So it's as told by his wife?
It's as told by his wife. So he is obviously the sort of shadowy figure throughout. But actually, for those who are put off because they think, well, I don't know much about Shakespeare and I find Shakespeare very difficult or challenging or whatever, it doesn't actually matter at all. You really don't need to know anything about Shakespeare or have ever read any Shakespeare or studied it. It's just a really wonderful, very, very, very moving story about grief.
So, because I think I've been in my head like, oh, it's people throwing, going to the toilet in the bucket and throwing out the window. Yeah. But... is it
that's
closer to something like American Wife, which I just
oh my god, American
I can't
Wife.
Stop thinking about it.
Hang on, why would American Wife be about
because
grief?
It's the wife of high profile person, and it is about grief because she can't get over Andrew Imhoff, who she killed in the accident.
That's true. Oh yeah, I read American Wife a while ago now, but that was the first one of hers I read.
Or on my way out of New York.
No, it's not. No, it is. That's a really fair, actually, astute comparison. I suppose this is sort of buckets of wee being thrown out of the window onto the sort of cobbled streets below. It is a bit of that, and actually, I think the wife, she's like a sort of apothecary. So there's lots of sort of ye olde cures and things that they try, and that's all quite sort of atmospheric and evocative.
Is that something that you really enjoy in the book, that sense of history and
I
place?
I really do. And actually, there's a couple of others here, but we'll get onto that. But there's, weirdly, specifically Victorian. I was always quite obsessed with the Victorians. And so there's a couple of Sarah Waters buried under here. And also Elizabeth McNeil's second book. Do you know what I mean?
She wrote The Doll Factory.
And then Circus of Wonders was her second one, which I think I loved even more.
Oh, well, let's get those out.
Oh, here we go. So it's a proof. That's Circus of Wonders, which is, I can't recommend enough. It's basically about...
That was out this year.
Yeah.
Beautiful proof.
Yeah, isn't it? Got the gold foil. So you read The Doll Factory, right? Which is great.
I have not actually read The Doll Factory.
Well, The Doll Factory is Victorian. And I think she just has that real ability of, being able to sort of hear, like, horses clopping down the street. And you know, when you sort of watch a BBC period drama and they've sort of nailed that whole scene, Elizabeth McNeil sort of does it in a really magical way. And so this one, her second novel, is about a Victorian travelling circus. It's a bit like sort of The Greatest Showman, but more realistic, like the actual sort of brutalities, presumably, of being, you know, an exhibit in one of these circuses. And there's a love story, a really wonderful love story, runs throughout it. This really made me also want to try and give historical fiction a go myself. But I mean, Elizabeth McNeil, I actually messaged her when I finished this because I thought it was so wonderful. And she went to UEA. She used to work in PR. She was so funny. She came back, she said, I used to send you press releases. And so she used to work in PR, and then she went to UEA and did creative writing. And then I think wrote The Doll Factory. I think she was working on that when she was there. And then wrote this, and she's just such a brilliant talent. They must have been optioned, because both of them would make really good TV series or films. She's just, very, very, very talented. And
I am sold. I'm definitely going to give that a go. But let's go to Sarah Waters here. That has been on the telly.
Sarah Waters, yeah. So I remember actually being... I think the Tipping the Velvet came out... That's actually not a Victorian one. Tipping the Velvet, I think it came out when I was a teenager, and I've been quite scandalised. I think what she called Diana Rigg's daughter... What's she called? Dark hair. Rachel Sterling, I think, was one of them. And I remember being quite scandalised because the sex scenes are quite full on, I think. Did you ever see that adaptation?
Yes, and I remember there's lots of sort of...
In fact, for writing erotic stuff, actually, it's quite... Yeah, this is good... sort of Victorian eroticism. This actually isn't my... So this is Tipping the Velvet, which I do love. My favourite one of Sarah Waters is Fingersmith. Have you read that? Which is so wonderful.
I have not read Fingersmith. I'm very badly read.
No, because you read much more than me. But she... So I haven't got it because a friend... I come to her really late. It was in lockdown last year, the beginning of lockdown. A friend of mine lent me Fingersmith, saying, oh my God, I can't believe you haven't read it. And I don't really want... There's a really good sort of... twist. I don't want to it's like a really brilliant gear change about halfway through, which I just don't think anyone could see coming if you're a reader, and you're just like, what? And again, it's very Victorian and sort of Dickensian in terms of atmosphere, and I just love that, like getting lost in those worlds.
Is that what you were craving at the start of lockdown? Maybe. A real sense of being in another time, in another place?
Escaping the misery of 2020. What were we last April for? The misery of, 1878 or something. And the sort of, stinking streets. I went through a real phase of then reading book after book after book of hers. Sort of gorging in a way, which I actually think sometimes you can have too much of a good thing.
And things do blend into each other a bit.
A little bit.
You can't remember them discreetly.
A little bit. And that also, she's such a wonderful writer. I think it's sort of greedy in a way, because you think, well, just pace yourself. Like, try not to swallow them all in one go. Just
I have had that when I'm like, oh no, I really want to treat myself. I'm going to read something else. And I look down and I'm, oh no.
Or the same author.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose if you love someone, then you want to carry on reading the same person. But I just did, I think I did about four in a row. And then I was like, okay, probably we'll leave Victorian London for a bit and do something contemporary.
Sort of walk down the road and be like, there's a Tesco Metro I don't understand.
Yes! Where are all the men in top hats? Yeah.
I've been eyeing up this book, which I'm desperate to ask you about because it looks amazing.
My God.
Mostly Men by Lynn Barber.
So the reason I got that was an old colleague when I worked at Tatler, I think he had a copy of it. and I was doing interviews at Tatler, and I've always been really, I find, when I'm doing journalism, I find doing interviews, it's like quite intimidating, and I like just being sent off to interview, you know, a famous person, or, you know, not offending them and not upsetting them. Quite difficult. So I remember David recommending that I get this.
What do you do?
But like, well, do you know what I mean? Like, increasingly these days, you've got to be so careful, I think. You're not allowed to ask the celebrity this. You're not allowed to ask the celebrity that. You've got to be sort of quite careful, I guess, with certain interviews, particularly Tatler, I think. You just have to sort of be sent off to interview lots of posh people. Lots of dukes. I was constantly interviewing dukes.
You're going and like pulling your trousers down and farting. I don't understand why they're all so upset with me.
No, it wasn't that bad, but I do remember interviewing loads of dukes at Tatler and always being quite, you know, like quite intimidated rocking up at Beaver Castle or what's the one that Harry Potter's at, Alnwick, to interview the Duke of Northumberland once. And he'd be like, anyway, to try and stop being so pathetic, I remember David saying, well, why don't you read, you know, Lynn Barber's book, Mostly Men, which is old, but, you know, she's like very, very, very experienced old hand at interviewing. And it is the most extraordinary. So I got this on eBay, I think. And it is the most extraordinary book. When was it published? It was published in... first published 1991.
Oh, wow.
So they're all interviews, as the title would suggest. They're mostly interviews with men. There are a couple of women who sneak in.
I think of something Janie Lloyd Fox might have published in the Gilly Cooper universe.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. That's really true. But and the interviews are, I mean, they are extraordinary. In fact, as homework for this, I was reading one this morning. It's one with Jimmy Savile, which is actually quite hard to read because I think it was in 1990, and she goes on a tour of Stoke Mandeville with him, and it's just extraordinary. Is it lowering the tone to read out a bit? It just is. Oh, it was a real like moment in time. We just think.
This is what I failed as a journalist in an interview because I'm like, should I ask you to read or not? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Well, we could always cut it out. But there's a bit at the end.
It's
almost
like haunted.
There's here, but listen to this. So this was written in. This is amazing. This is written in. She did this interview July 1990. The penultimate paragraph. Touring the Stoke Mandeville wards with him is a disconcerting experience. When he coos over a young woman paraplegic, aha, now I can have my way with you, my dear. One can only pray that she appreciates the joke. I remember the most frightening thing anyone ever said to me was when I was being wheeled in for a back operation. This is Lynn Barber speaking. And the junior doctor remarked cheerily, we'll have you walking again in 2 weeks. And if we don't, we'll send Jimmy Savile to visit you. Much as I admire Sir James Savile, he is someone I never, ever want to be visited by. Isn't that extraordinary? Like, it's, and there are so many paragraphs in this. There are lots of paragraphs in this interview, actually. I was like, oh my God, I almost might tweet that because it's so sort of...
And that's over 30 bizarre. Years old.
But yeah, but then I sort of didn't want to get Land Linen. Yeah, I mean, she addresses it. Even then, she addresses it. The fact that for the past several years, tabloid journalists have been saying that he must have a serious skeleton in his cupboard. Otherwise, he would have got knighthood by now. And he just obviously denies it. Anyway, there's a really good one with the Getty, the original Getty, John Getty. It's just really brilliant sort of historical account of all these interviews, as well as being quite a good lesson in sort of how to do interviews. So I love this. And I just dip into it, you know, because they're all, how many, you know, there must be like 30 interviews or something. You can just dip in if you want to read Lynn Barber on Barry Manilow, for example.
I really do.
Well, I think I probably got it for about £3 on eBay. But anyway, yeah, it's been super useful and sort of fascinating, as well as a bit depressing in moments.
In a way, lots of things do not change nearly as much as we believe them to have changed. But then I think it's really good that that remains as a record of how we thought about things and
exactly.
What we did. And I think we need to remember
how some things change. And also just as a sort of historical document, this book, or historical, tome. It's just so fascinating. All these, I mean, imagine having the access to all these people that she's interviewed. Yeah. Ronnie Biggs. The Roald Dahl one in here is really good.
I
reread that again this morning, and he's sort of there's a really brilliant bit when they have quite a posh lunch outside, you know, that amazing house that he had. He lived in the Cotswolds. Was it the Cotswolds? No, it was Oxfordshire. Okay. somewhere
there. It's sort of Buckinghamshire.
That's what I mean. It's sort of around there. It's a sort of, I think it had beams, sort of Tudor-y thing. Anyway, but they have this quite posh lunch outside. Oh yeah, here we go. We adjourn for lunch in the garden where an array of exquisite salads await us under the vine trellis. It's all very elegant until we come to pudding is a Tupperware box full of chocolate bars. And then he goes on this great thing about how he's obsessed with like Twixes, Crunchies, Mars, Maltesers, Kit Kats, and therefore Willy Wonka, right? Because he was obsessed with chocolate. And obviously he knew lots about chocolates. In fact, it made me start to think, I want to write about this guy. So the original Mars guy, John Forrest Mars, was the Leonardo. His father had a little chocolate factory in Chicago and invented Milky Way. But he told his son, there's no room here for both of us. So John went off to England and invented the Mars bar over here. Isn't that, I mean, oh, I quite want to read, I quite want a TV series like on that or a book on that. Anyway, so then, right, then Roald Dahl just sits.
Howard's Way with chocolate. Yes, please.
Yes, exactly. So then Roald Dahl just goes off on this interview about his favourite chocolate bars and about how in his study he has a ball that is the size of a tennis ball but 20 times as heavy, made from all the silver paper wrapped together from all the chocolate bars that he's eaten in his life. Anyway, so it just has all these little glimpses into these amazing people, this book, that you just wouldn't find, you know, we can find out so much on the, you know, if I'm ever researching stuff for my journalism work, you know, you obviously go straight onto the internet. But there's stuff that this, none of this would necessarily be on there because they're super old interviews that you'd never find anywhere else. So, yeah, I love it.
And I know with Roald Dahl, you know, problematic as he is, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, even now, I never forget so much about yearning and wanting and not having. And, yeah, you know, in a world where you feel like you don't have and not everyone, and that Charlie as a character isn't, you know, greedy or selfish or grasping. He's not. He's just sort of hopeful.
Yes.
And you root for him.
Yeah.
And is it Grandpa Joe? He's his sort of
Grandpa
cheerleader.
Grandpa. Yeah. Well, I think that's true with all his books, isn't it, in a way? There's the sort of adults are all quite often, I'm thinking about Matilda now as well. She's quite hopeful. You know, Matilda has that amazing skill, this sort of magical skill, and is the good, sort of pure child in a world of less pure, actually bad grown-ups, like Miss Trunchbull and her parents, and then there's lovely Miss Honey. I can't remember James and the Giant Peach. Is that the same? Are there adults
horrible
in that?
Aunts. And
horrible
then
aunts,
I can't quite
twits.
Remember how they get the peach out. I believe there's birds. And so they have
there's loads of insects. Are there animals?
I think so. And the insects live in the peach.
See, hi, when James you wrote that. I mean, that's shrunk. A bit of an odd one, isn't it? Yeah.
But that obviously there's someone there who every time he ate a chocolate bar in his back garden in a sort of, you know, palatial surroundings and can't quite believe that his life has taken such a turn that he can have as much chocolate as he wants whenever he wants it.
Yeah, he just happens after his Tupperware. No, I suppose that's...
And that you think that's an impressive thing to bring for someone for pudding. And it kind of is, actually, isn't it? Because how many times have you had a disappointing posh pudding and thought, I'd quite like a Dairy Milk at this point, to be honest.
I feel like we did this at one of those endless mad pieces that we did at Tatler, how people, I'm sure we declared at some point the chicest thing to do was to cook some, you know, smart dinner and then throw a bar of Dairy Milk on the table as pudding, which is, like, really easy and lovely to do. That and a coffee, you're done.
Oh, the dream. Do you have any food books you love, be they recipe books or novels where food features?
Actually, you know, one of the books that I would have loved to have here, but because everything so much is still in boxes, it'll be next door in a box somewhere. I was going to mention it's slightly cheating, but it's Laura Freeman's The Reading Cure. Because I used to work with Laura and she wrote this really moving book about how she, I always hesitate to say the words, got over anorexia because I think a lot of people would say you sort of never get over it, you're constantly sort of dealing with it. Anyway, how she sort of overcame her anorexia by reading books about food. And it's such a beautiful book. It starts off with, I think there's one Christmas where she decides to set herself the challenge of reading when she sets herself the challenge of reading every single book that Dickens ever wrote. In the sort of way, I remember this from a lot of my friends who had problems like with eating, there's a form, you try and exert a form of control over sort of lots of aspects of your life. And Laura, I think this was a form of control. She sort of set herself this very difficult task of reading every single book that Dickens wrote in a year. I don't know how many books Dickens wrote, but a lot, right? So it was quite a big,
and they're all big books.
So they're not sort of slimline volumes, maybe apart from Christmas Carol, probably, maybe is the skinniest. Anyway, so she starts reading all these books and then she has this sort of epiphany where she says she realises that in Dickens, maybe a bit like in Roald Dahl, the jolly characters, and this is certainly true, I think, in A Christmas Carol, are the ones who eat, and the ones who are sort of fun and kind are the ones who get stuck into the figgy pudding or the goose or whatever. Christmas Carol experts will shout at me, but you know, the Cratchits get their goose and then they're the lovely ones, whereas there's Scrooge, who sort of is very miserly and tiny and measly about food, I think. And so it kickstarts this journey that Laura goes on herself. I hate talking about people going on journeys, but she does, and she starts reading lots of books about food, and there's a brilliant chapter quite early on where she goes through, I think she calls it her war poets phase, and she reads about the joy that they would take that soldiers in the trenches would take in a cup of tea. And Laura writes about how at the time she'd stopped drinking milk in her tea because she worked out that the milk that you put into a cup of tea is, I don't know, say 20 calories per cup of tea. And she worked out if she had 4 cups of tea a day, that was 80 calories a day times 7. What's 80 times 7? 560, maybe? 560 calories a week that she could, in that, you know, very controlling way, had just decided to strip milk out because that would cut back her calorific intake. And she really cleverly writes about reading about the war poets and their love of tea and then managing to bring herself to have a proper cup of tea. And it's so fun. It was when I was working with her on a journalist on a news desk. And I was always the one. I have quite firm opinions about tea. I don't like other people making my tea because I know exactly how I like it. I can be quite a control freak about things. And so I used to do the tea run, and I went downstairs and got a tray. You know, it was just like crappy polystyrene cups and not very exciting, but it was proper tea. And Laura always said no. Whenever I said I was off downstairs to get the tea, she'd always be like, no, I'm okay. And then one time she said yes, and she said she was sort of so proud of it. She sat there and she was so proud of herself, sort of having her proper cup of char and her milk and a tea. Exactly. And I sort of wailed when I read this because I didn't know any of this at the time. I didn't know that she was having such a hard time. So The Reading Cure is just one of my favourite books, and I feel a bit bad talking about it here because, you know, she's a mate, but it is really a brilliant book. And then I think she goes on to Roald Dahl. It's just a really wonderful, evocative book with lots of foodie things
in
literature.
It's so moving, though. I mean, that, you know, having, and you're part of that story, and that, you know, it's part of the canon, just as the chocolate is. I'm quite emotional in that, thinking about what that you never ever know what someone is living or what they're doing through. And then, you know, just sort of doing a tea run, which feels like to you the most normal thing in the world, and
so
for her, really not.
Yeah, and she then sat there at her desk probably feeling really proud of herself that she'd managed to, like, have that extra 20 calories in her cup of tea. It was,
I haven't read The Reading Cure, but I'm going to rush out and buy it immediately.
It's very wonderful. I think she found it quite hard to write, but I think it was very cathartic, and it's a really, really brilliant book. So, yeah, I really recommend it. I think mothers, that, you know, anybody who's got children going through anorexia, or, you know, it's useful. It's the clearest depiction I've ever read about the mental sort of torture of it all, and how, you know, mentally you feel when you're in the grip of that. She's really brilliant.
Because I just interviewed Ivana Lynch, who wrote a memoir about her eating disorder, the opposite of butterfly hunting, and I was really taken aback by how well she writes, and also how she really captures what her family had gone through. And I've read things that really are quite, you know, miserable and quite sort of one note, and there's a real sort of fullness and life and a gallows humour, but also it's
clever of her.
It's entirely about, you know, the emotional side and the obsessive side, and I don't think at any point she ever says, like, I weighed this and I was this size, and it's really kind of thoughtful in that way.
I think people are quite careful about that now, aren't they? Not to, because one person's size is, you know, completely different from another person's size. Yeah, it's really weird. I feel like our generation, our age, right, I'm 36, I remember being at school and it was, like, rife. It was really bad and not very talked about. We had this hideous thing at my school where we were weighed. It was a boarding school, and we were weighed at the start, the beginning and end of every term. You'd lost, I mean, it seems extraordinary now, if you had lost too much weight, you'd be put on, you'd have to go and eat in the sand with the nurse. And the way that all the girls knew if you were, like, sort of on sand watch was you'd have to get your tray at lunch, and you'd literally have to walk, there was a spiral staircase that went up to the sand, you'd have to walk through the dining room and then go up that spiral staircase with your tray. I mean, it's just sort of so medieval in a way that that's how it was treated. Really not that long ago, like, we're talking 20 years ago. So I think anybody who can write about it now, I have so much admiration for.
Because that's pretty much the opposite of any kind of effective treatment, surely, if someone is that unhappy.
Sort of publicly, publicly shaming. It does feel sort of, like I said, very medieval, or more Victorian in a way, sort of treating girls who are really struggling, sort of publicly shaming them. So I think that's why I found Laura's book so moving as well, and anyone who can write about it, because it was so much a part of, like, my teenage years. I just remember constantly sort of friends going through obviously really bad moments. So I really take my hat off to anybody who can do it.
I think in a sort of equally teen-tastic but perhaps slightly cheerier way, I believe is that a Mills and Boon?
Yes. I've got a pile of them. So for my last book, the mother character is obsessed with Mills and Boons, and my heroine starts sneaking into her room when she's a teenager to to steal her mother's Mills and Boone, and it sort of kickstarts this like romantic explosion. And so I ordered loads of these. You know, on eBay you can get. I think people sell Mills and Boone, old Mills and Boone, by the sort of yard practically,
oh, like,
or by the box, So I bought. I mean, I think I've got more somewhere, but I just love the covers.
These covers are fantastic.
Vision so of love, and there's this sort of quite dashing sandy-haired man with his jumper knotted around his neck and a. No, it's not a Christmas tree, is it? It's some sort of tree.
Oh, because I thought it looked kind of snowy.
Oh, look,
but now I see
you.
A palm tree.
Oranges.
And a sun hat. Ooh.
Spitfire.
I had to take a picture of that.
You have to, yeah.
Sexy. I like Man for Hire, and I've got Highland Gathering.
They're so great. And people, you know what? I hate literary snobbery, don't we all? But
yes, you wrote that brilliant piece that for
really
the eye paper
strongly about it. I mean, snobbery of any form is obviously very tedious, isn't it? But literary snobbery, making someone else feel small about what they choose to get into the bath with, or get into bed with, or lie on the sofa reading. Like, why does anybody need to do that? If someone likes, you know, Mills and Boone, great. They're really brilliant love stories, and you can get swept up.
We have, going back to Dukes, we have a mutual acquaintance, I guess. The Duchess of York, she's still the Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson.
Yes.
Fergie, who...
you interviewed her, didn't you?
I did, and I mentioned you, and she said, "That's the fire money coots, is fantastic." In that really husky way.
That's
she has.
So sweet.
But I've really enjoyed her Heart for a Compass.
Do you know what? I have got it, and I haven't... I feel really bad. Here's me waxing lyrical about Mills and Boone, and I haven't read it. Yeah, I just think... people who are snotty about this sort of thing are mean. Fine, read your very, very, very highbrow, you know, books if you like, and then other people can read Mills and Boone. Like, why judge people, really? It really drives me mad. And I not long after I wrote that piece, which was in the summer, I was on a panel chat at the lovely Prima Donna Festival, and that was all about romantic books and novels. And we got onto the topic of snobbery, and then I made the point I make in that piece, which is, and it's not to, I'm not trying to trash Sally Rooney in any way, but you know, Normal People is a love story. It's a very brilliantly written teenage love story.
And quite honestly, I think that's sold in its squillions, not necessarily because everyone, you know, like the fine literary style, because people shipped Marianne and Connor
because she hasn't got speech marks. I don't think it's anything to do with that. Exactly, it's because people love a love story, and I, you know, had Normal People had a very, very different cover that maybe looked a bit more like Impetuous Masquerade, people might have been snottier about it. And I'm not saying they should be at all, but I'm just, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to marketing, doesn't it? But I do think anybody who sniffs at a book, a certain kind of book, it just drives me mad. Like, whether someone's sniffing at someone for reading highbrow stuff or lowbrow stuff, like, just everyone can read what they like, frankly, in my book.
Is, you know, deep down, we all know that people, the difference between what the books are sort of, you know, talked about and verified by, and the things that people are actually buying and excited about reading.
And can't wait to get into bed with.
Yes.
Which might not be the latest 900-page book about Stalingrad. Do you know what I mean? Like, it might be a Mills and Boone. Why not, frankly? It's so stupid. I always say, Marianne Keyes is so good on this on her Desert Island Discs, when it was a Kirsty Young one, and Kirsty sort of asks her about, you know, this topic, and how does she feel to sort of be denigrated, I suppose. Not denigrated, but sort of cast as a writer of popular fiction, and that's in the way that popular is used as a slightly damning word. And Marianne comes straight back and says, well, it's popular, isn't it? And she's so right, you know, like millions and millions of people have bought Marianne's wonderful books, and
absolutely,
anybody being snotty about that is just, it's madness.
And honestly, I have been so comforted and so helped by Marianne's, all of the books, they're like wise
exactly.
and subtle.
Look at Rachel, yeah,
in
look
a way.
At Rachel's Holiday. It's
and if they
the
had been
themes that she
in
tackles.
A really sort of, you know, I don't know, big fan of Faber as a publisher, and I think do fantastic things, but they've had a sort of very like obscure Faber, you know, that I might not have found them when I needed them the most.
Yeah, exactly. True. I think, yeah, I agree with all of that. I just think each of their own, really. Don't judge others. I mean, I always say this about TV as well. People who are snotty about people's TV watching habits, just let everyone read what they want. And why make yourself try and feel better, basically, because that's what it is, snobbery. It's trying to make yourself feel better by slagging off someone else's choices, and it's just really mean.
More than ever, when there is so damn much to read and watch, and it's endless, and I don't think there's really any point. When there was sort of like, oh, the 20 books you must read this year, it really was just those 20 books. Like, fair enough, have a go. But now it does feel infinite.
The other thing that I got into this conversation, this applies to this conversation as well. Have you read The Idea Review by Robin Lee?
Oh, do you know, I've had that recommended to me so many
times.
Well,
because I got into a conversation at a hen party this summer.
That's a cracking cover.
Natasha, well, this is a proof, I think, with Natasha Lunn about this. She said she was reading The Idea Review by Robin Lee and that she knew various people who were being really snotty about it. So, do you know the premise? It's basically Harry Styles fan fiction.
Oh, no, I didn't
know. But it's a novel. So it's basically, I think he's called Hayes. It's a 39-year-old divorced mom, because it's in America, who takes her teenage daughters to see the world's biggest boy band. And they get backstage tickets or something. And they're in the lineup and the daughters are meeting the boys. And then Hayes, Harry, essentially, immediately there's chemistry with the mum, the 39-year-old divorced mum. And then they're sort of, you know, I don't want to give away too many spoilers. But they, you know, they embark on this sort of passionate affair. And it's, as Natasha said, you know, you'll read it in sort of 48 hours, if not 24 hours, but it's so wonderful, and I got really swept up in it. And God, I'm not going to read the last line, but I remember doing that dramatic thing wherever I was reading it, of clapping my hand on my chest when I finished, because it's really moving, the end. And again, it's not, you know, lots of people would probably be really snotty about it, but it's really, really escapist and brilliant. And that's the other thing at the moment, which is, if people want to escape, frankly, everything that's going on outside in the real world, why not pick up something wonderful like this, which you properly can't put down? It's really fun.
I hesitate to sort of describe a 39-year-old woman as an older woman at the age of 36 myself, but that's something that you don't see. And I think it's interesting that so, you know, laughed at and sneered at and dismissed as frivolous. And it's like, no, it's really radical to have that as a story.
Yeah,
to
exactly.
To have someone pursuing satisfaction and fulfilment and joy.
Oh, yeah, I totally see what you mean about the older woman. Exactly. Well, a 39-year-old woman, and I think he's 19 or something. It's quite empowering in a way to have that. And the sex is great. I really actually was sort of slightly taking notes about how she... It's very hard to write chemistry. I try and, you know, a lot of the sex scenes that I write, I try and write them funny, because I always think sex is quite, you know, funny sort of hobby, isn't it? Like, what are we doing? Why are you putting that there?
Who came up with this?
Yeah, exactly.
How have we survived as a species?
This is a
baffling.
Really bizarre pastime.
You do excellent, funny, sexy.
But I find it really hard to do, you know, to try and do a sort of serious, moving, like really intimate sex scene. But she, I've just opened it on a page and he's just gone, we're almost out of condoms. He stated matter of factly. So that's like less touching, perhaps. But
very real, though.
Oh, that's when I think he sends his bodyguard out to buy condoms. I've just remembered. there's definitely like this sort of sexy chemistry in this. So I really recommend it for a bit of escapist, a romp, basically. It's great.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back with Sophia soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Don't Tell Alfred, a Nancy Mitford classic. Fanny, who we first met in The Pursuit of Love, is off to Paris to run the British Embassy with her husband, the eponymous Alfred. But her glamorous role becomes chaotic thanks to rebellions, runaway pop stars, her dreamy niece Northy, and confusion all round. This is giddy, smart, escapist fun, and Lord knows we all need a vicarious trip to Paris. Don't Tell Alfred is published by Penguin and out now. Now back to Sophia.
But that's the funny thing, isn't it? That obviously there's a bit of an out loud sneer. And I'd not heard anything negative about that, but I've just had a few pals WhatsApping me screenshots being like, oh my God, this book, I love it so much.
Maybe we've changed a bit about the snobbery, about sort of the idea that you're being piled high and selling tens of thousands of copies is looked down on. But who doesn't want to sell tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of copies? It's so mad. Surely, if you're a writer, I mean, that's not, you know, the only goal, but that is potentially a goal.
I think you write to reach people and you write to, you know, to entertain and move and transport. And, like, personally, I'd much rather, you know, someone who sort of said, like, I read it in, you know, a weekend.
Yeah.
And I wanted to read it again. And rather than that sort of, like, I think, you know, this is a searing sort of language. I mean, I'd like to do that too. But
that's so funny when people, do you ever get that when people message you? I sometimes think, they say, I inhaled it in like 3 hours. And I sometimes think, oh God, I shouldn't be that easy. Should be more like sort of like maybe 8 hours.
Weeks, just chuck another log of mornings, where you've been sitting down, working.
Yeah, like, that took me months to write. You can't just whip through it in 3 hours. I'm never quite sure if people can read. Maybe some people can read books in 3 hours. But yeah, it's a funny one.
Can you think of a book of when did you last really feel
really inhale
like,
one?
Or the first time you were like, I can't do anything until I have finished this?
The first time, I'm trying to think, when I was younger, it probably would have been like early Gilly Cooper, maybe. The most recent one, well, that would be up there. What else have I read recently that I've really, really, really inhaled? Oh, is there one on here? I think there's... Oh, my God. Well, can we talk about... Well, this basically was a book that I it's gone in straight into my top five or three
wow.
favourites, I think.
And this is Still Life by Sarah Winman,
Still Life. And I did read When God Was a Rabbit, which was one of hers, but I can't remember. I'm really bad at remembering books. I love books, big fan of books. Quite often, once I've read one, and I'll have a sort of vague, nebulous feeling about a book will stay in my head, but ask me to regurgitate a plot and I couldn't necessarily tell you. So I'm very bad at remembering them, but so I can't remember When God Was a Rabbit, but this one, Still Life, which came out recently, I think I just got it. I've got a really good independent bookshop up the road here in Crystal Palace, and I went in and got
that,
it. Books at a Crow.
Yes.
So good, run by Lovely Jonathan. And I got it in there because I'd heard good things about it, and it is, so it starts at the end of the Second World War, and then it sort of dots about between London, and then a lot of it is set in Florence. And it's just the characters, I think. Her characters are really, really wonderful. And she absolutely has that ability, which is really hard, I think, to make you properly laugh with certain characters and certain pages, and then weep on the next page. And I think that's such a difficult thing to pull off. Like, obviously a lot of writers can do, you know, intensely serious, and a lot of writers can be very funny, but I think managing to do both is very difficult. I think the same thing about Soren Bliss. I think she pulled Meg Mason pulls that off as well, how writers can make you roar with laughter and then sort of roar with tears the next page.
I'm desperate to read that because I love Tin Man. I couldn't tell you anything about it. I just remember reading it. I think so. I read it.
When God Was a Rabbit, A Year of Marvelous Ways, Tin Man.
I remember reading it on holiday and getting to the end and weeping and just feeling very...
Because you finished like, it was so beautiful, both.
All of it, I think. Lots of highs and lows.
This actually made me want to go to... most of it is set in Florence, to be honest, and it's just the characters are so wonderful, and there's a talking parrot who makes you laugh the whole way through, and her names are very good. Like, yeah, Evelyn is a main character, and there's Ulysses who's a main character. Their names, I love, you know, names are so important. But I did want to go, so I'm finishing off my new book at the moment. I was going to try and go to Florence and stay in a sort of cheap Airbnb for sort of a week in November and try and finish. I had this grand artistic idea of finishing my book out there, and then I realised my passport was out of date, so I needed to get a new passport. That's fine. But I just wanted to go to Florence and drink wine and eat pasta and go to all the places that that these characters do in here.
No, I want that too, but I'm going to read this book and I will get to go.
And then can we talk about it? It's just her writing, yeah, and the sense of place is really magical.
Oh, yeah. But we can talk about Summer and Bliss, which I was almost annoyed by how good
Brilliant.
That was.
I sort You're of not the itched only writer. With it. Another writer friend of mine messaged me saying, how can we write like this? Yeah, I mean, it was just so sensationally brilliant, wasn't it? And she absolutely, like, the I've got quite a sort of dysfunctional English family in that sort of way, and I totally got... There are some quite hideous Christmases, aren't there, in that, when they all have to gather.
And the amazing aunt, who again has... I can't remember what she's called, but she's got an incredible name. She's not tense, is she?
And she's the nice one, isn't she? She comes and when she's sitting on her bed, she comes and talks to her at one point.
But it's almost like the slow reveal and the myth of it being like, oh, these like are ghastly mother's family and they're just dreadful. And then learning who the real villains are. And there's books I love that are so rare and it's so brilliantly done. And I think this is Rachel's Holiday too, when you've got the unreliable narrator and the narrator is only learning how unreliable they are.
Exactly. Yes, that's so true about the parents, because I think at the beginning of Sorin Bliss, we're sort of amused by the family, aren't we? We're sort of amused by the madness of her parents. And then we... Is it fair to say that as you get through the book, it becomes apparent they're sort of amusing but also sort of awful.
It's
really dysfunctional.
And darker than we think. And in the nicest way, it's almost like a trope. Because I think that sort of lovely, cosy, rackety, eccentric family setup, we think we know it from the books we love. And there's a slow twist and you're like, oh. Yeah. Oh, like, there's this weird book. Have you read any Laurie Colwyn?
I have just read one. The one set in New York. Are they all set in New York?
They're pretty much all set
in
New York.
Okay, good. That's helpful.
Happy All the Time?
Yes, I think it's Happy All the Time. About like two men getting married.
Vincent Guido.
Yes. But also good names, yeah.
There's one, and I think Happy All the Time is her best novel. I've now read all the novels.
Which they just re-released some?
Yeah, they're a bit tricky to get a hold of. So my editions are quite odd, and some are really quite fabulously odd, but I love them.
Nice.
Family happiness. It's about the heroine Polly is having an affair with this lovely painter, and it's like how two really nice people that you adore can be causing themselves and their family so much misery, but it's all secret. Family happiness, in a way, is a little bit like Sorrow and Bliss, and it's playing with that notion of the anxious wasp, but happy all the time.
And just the dynamics between parents and children and then siblings. And I think, I'm always drawn to books where there are complicated family relationships.
Her relationship with her sister in Sorrow and Bliss. It just made me want to weep and crumple.
And when is it her sister who comes and gets her at one point?
Yeah.
And there's a real breakdown. Yeah, it's really... That's how it started, wasn't it? I think I have listened or I've read an interview with her. I think it started, she wanted to start writing it as a sister relationship, and then it sort of grew from there. But she felt pretty despondent about it at certain points, I think, didn't she, Meg Mason? I think she sort of wasn't very confident about the book at all. But it just, it was one of my favourite ones this summer. It was just extraordinary. I might even reread. I don't think I've ever reread a book, but I would. Yeah, no, I normally just think, okay, well, that was really beautiful and I loved it. But I don't need to, because there are so many books to read. Well, because there were so many, but I don't know about you. Now that you write books, do you read them in a very different way? I read much more forensically, I think, than I used to, which makes it sound very unromantic. Like I'm sitting there sort of with my pencil making notes. I'm not. But I do, I find down to sort of sentence structure and words used, I'm much more interested in it than I used to be, because I used to sort of just think, oh, well, that's, lovely, a sort of you get an overarching picture of a chapter or a book or a story, and now I'm like, that's interesting how they've structured that little bit, and like even chapter structure and stuff, I'm quite like, oh, that's interesting where they just stopped. So
something I notice is when I don't like the way something's done, I feel taken out of the story, and rereading, I feel like much more of a student, and that's where I really learn how things have been done and also the bits that are memorable in the books and the bits that I come back to and think, oh, I love this bit. And like quite often they're not necessarily like, oh, it's a big plot point. It's a
very subtle little thing.
Yeah.
Which is so annoying. So like, oh, they're so clever. They did that.
Yeah. Or just knowing, having, characters who don't necessarily contribute to the plot. And again, I think Marion Keyes does this so brilliantly, where there are so many people who populate her novels and you believe in everyone, like everyone who works in the offices, together.
Yeah.
They could be in their own novel.
Yeah.
Do you never even read Jilly Cooper?
Have I reread? I must have dipped in. I probably have. It's a really sweeping statement. I've never read any book. That's silly, isn't it? When I was a teenager, I probably did go back over the sort of Octavias and things, but I haven't reread any of the big ones. I haven't reread, Riders, Rivals, or Polo. Because then there were always more, there were more recent ones. We've got a visitor. Should we let her in? And then, is that annoying?
Hiya, how are you doing?
Oh, not too bad.
Hi, And please welcome to the podcast, returning guest Cassandra Hodge.
Oh, hello, hi, sorry, I just sort of have crashed somewhat.
I heard about French fancies, you see,
so I couldn't really resist because I was a bit lonely at home.
This isn't too much of an ambush. I'd love to ask you both, like, what are the books that you share and that you lend each other? Did you, because you were both working together, am I right in thinking, at Tatler?
Yes.
Did you do much sharing of books as colleagues?
Guy's much cleverer than me, so.
That's not true. I just show off about it more.
No, you have lent me a book actually recently. No, tell you what, Gav's husband actually lent me Exciting Times, Nisha Dolan.
Yes.
I love that. I don't think I've lent Gav anything very brilliant.
That's not true, no, you lent me Hamlet.
Oh, well, then you have to.
I thought it was such a wonderful book.
Well, we're talking about that because Daisy was saying she, I think a lot of people, and I felt this, was quite intimidated to begin with because I didn't know Hamlet. And I was like, well, you must have to have an understanding of Hamlet before you read it. And then I picked it up and was like, well, that's nonsense, actually.
I think it's such a kind of wonderful historical evocation, but at the same time, sort of personal, emotional, individual, and kind of evocation of grief that transcends the centuries.
See, she's much cleverer than me, all those words.
And I feel terrible for really putting you on the spot.
Yeah, I know.
Because Andrew really has just walked through the door. She's got a scarf on.
Well, I literally just came in for the French fancies and to say hi.
I really wanted to ask you this, about this, because...
I have to... So the reason I've got both of these out is because they're both... So my parents have both written books. So this is my mum's... This is so indulgent. This is my mum's book about marmalade. So my mum...
You have given me that as well.
Oh, I've given Gavin marmalade, but... My mum wrote... She's the world's best marmalade maker. I'm biased,
so,
obviously.
This is The Little Book of Marmalade by Lucy Deeds.
By Lucy Deeds. Lovely foil
I
cover.
I thought... She, isn't there some official ranking? Isn't she actually...
Well, there is this wonderful event I have been to three times before, actually, in my life, called the World Marmalade Awards, which takes place in Cumbria every year. And I went up to that, and mum did get a gold medal at one stage for one of her marmalades, which was very exciting.
Did it have any twist on the classic form?
Yeah, so there are different... The World Marmalade Awards, they have like 11 or 12 categories. They have... It wasn't... There's like boozy marmalade. There's children's marmalade. So lots of children enter. There's a really random category, which is campanologist marmalade, isn't that? I think that's bell ringers. Extraordinary. Have bell ringers. I didn't know that bell ringers... The Venn diagram of bell ringers and marmalade makers must be enormous. I didn't know that.
I feel like there must have been some bizarre accident that started all that off.
Maybe, I suppose. Yeah, exactly. If you are the sort of good person who rings your church bell every Sunday, feasibly, you might also be the sort of good person who has time to make marmalade. I don't know if you're sort of retiring.
You're equating the making of marmalade with virtue there, which I think is interesting.
Yes.
Maybe that's your mum has brainwashed you. Yes.
Guilt marmalade. Are you like, oh, I've done a terrible thing, so I better retain you.
Maybe,
bell ringing
maybe.
And preserves. Not your mum, though. Your mum.
No. My mum is pure as the driven snow. So anyway, so she wrote this lovely book and it's got all these sorts of different marmalades in. Marmalade, poor mum, and actually poor her four children. Not poor her four children, lucky her four children. We were eating marmalade recipes for quite a long time while this book was being made. But it was all delicious.
To come over all QVC for a minute, blimey, that is a good looking book. I want to get that for everyone I know for Christmas.
Yeah.
And listeners, you should too.
Yeah, it's a very good stocking filler.
It's really fit.
Very good stocking filler. It's just really sweet. And there's like marmalade cocktails and things in there as well. It's really fun.
So we should now talk about...
So sorry, now we're talking about my dad's book.
Where the Ocean Meets the Sky.
So my dad's a sailor. Well, he wasn't a sailor. He worked in sort of finance, really. But he was also he is a mad sailor. And he sailed the Atlantic solo about 16 years ago when he was 50. And so then he wrote a novel about it. He wrote it privately, actually. And then a sort of nautical or an adventure imprint picked it up and published it commercially.
Oh, so it is a novel, it's not a kind of a
sorry, it's not a novel, it's non-fiction, it's dad's account. Look, here's a picture of my dad, beardy, luckily the listeners can't necessarily see. That's my dad, he's actually naked in that picture, but he's sailing, he's beardy.
Well there's you a, don't wear a wheel to cover
when you sail,
the,
I you think, know. Across the Atlantic. I think if you ask Ben Fogle or James Cratton when they're rowing, you don't wear clothes. I think because the salt would get into the clothes and it chafes you, so you just have to put on loads of sun cream.
And a hat.
Anyway, this is a picture of my dad.
Respectfully.
And that's him when he finished. He was very beardy.
Very beard, very tanned. Not so, to be creepy about your dad, but very Mills and Boone vibe. 70s Mills and Boone.
Oh, he'd be delighted, Daisy, I'll tell him. But yeah, he like broke ribs, he got chased by pirates. It was all quite dramatic. And that was a picture he took, I think, of a storm coming in. So anyway, I was very proud.
So I love that you could conceivably have a sort of like a family
quite a mixed bag at the library.
I know you could, yeah. This could be an amazing selection for someone under the tree. A book. I want these all look so lovely, and I should really talk about the books I haven't read.
I haven't actually read that one.
I mean, I could always talk about Diana, but I want to talk about Early Morning Rise by Catherine Heine, because I love this book so much.
I love her. I didn't love it as much as Standard Deviation when I started it, and then the thing happens, which we can't really probably talk about because it's a big, obviously, plot point in the book. And have you read this, Gav?
I'm reading Standard Deviation. At the moment.
So this is her, Early Morning Riser is... Was that the one... Is this the follow-on? Was this the second one after? She's written short stories, hasn't she?
Single Carefree Mellow, which I read and I really, really loved. And it's interesting because I think the short stories read like notes for what was to come.
I've got it on my Kindle, I think.
And they're quite funny.
But this, I think, then I absolutely loved. Like, again, she's got that ability that we were talking about with Sarah Woman and I think with Meg Mason of, like... properly howling with laughter, like rocking the beds, howling with laughter sort of thing. And then, like particularly in this one, with what happens, just chest slapping, oh God, moments of feeling so sad or moved by
a particular
character. It's such a startling,
but what I think she writes so beautifully is about the goodness of people. And a bit like you're talking about the, not the novel Cure, is it called? The Reading Cure. That we never know about people ever. And it's the utter, utter goodness of... I can't remember the main guy's name, but you think he's this sort of, you know, handsome, strong...
Oh, the shagger.
Yeah.
The one who's a shagger.
And you sort of think, oh, here we go.
Duncan.
And then that you just really think there's something sort of spiritual here,
it's true. There's nobody really bad, actually, in either of her novels. And that's quite a relaxing place to be, I think. Even in Standard Deviation... there's the ex-wife. She's not bad, is she?
No.
She's just a bit sort of uptight.
She's just who she is.
Yeah.
And also has been wronged as well. So I think her behaviour is pretty sort of understandable.
Yeah, no one sort of evil. She's such a genius.
And that's because I know, back to old Laurie Colwyn, that Catherine Heine, I think, has written introductions to Laurie Colwyn. It's like a, you know, a fan and a scholar. And that feeling of when good people do bad things or do things that perhaps on paper seem hard to defend, but it's the way the world works that puts a person in that position. It's very, really generous writing, I think.
I hope there's many more to come from her, because I just love, I actually went to the bookshop. I went to Books at a Crow before 2 days before this was out and said, "Have you got it yet? Have you got it yet?" And he let me have an early copy.
Oh.
So exciting. Like it was Christmas.
That is why you must support your local indies,
exactly,
everybody.
Because they're very brilliant.
They will hook you up.
What else? I mean,
all right. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about?
This is the book. This is... just was quite important to me because this was the best book about egg freezing that I read, which I've recommended to a lot of women who have got in touch with me, obviously, because I wrote a lot about egg freezing.
This is, sorry to interrupt, In Her Own Sweet Time by Rachel Lehman Haupt.
Yes, she's American. And it actually came out, in terms of egg freezing and talking about this kind of stuff, it came out 6 years ago, I think, 2015. So a lot of it, a lot of like the medical side of things is probably a bit dated, but there were so many bits in here that as a woman who was thinking about egg freezing, who was 35 and single and weighing up, or 34 and single when I was thinking about it, did I really want to do it, it was really comforting. And there was a lot in here which I took from it. So I have recommended to a lot of women who've contacted me saying, I'm thinking about it. It's a really helpful bit. And it's a very lovely story about how she sort of weaves her way through the tricky, you know, field of being a 30 something, breaking up, meeting someone, maybe this is it, no, she breaks up again, oh, should I freeze, should I have a baby by myself. It's really, really moving and lovely. I recommend that for any women going through it.
What about I was going to suggest older P.G. Woodhouse.
That's what when I'm sad, Mikey and I read it to each other in bed and laugh.
Oh my god, that's me one. A husband wear one.
Well,
I mean,
do that, producer Dale.
Yeah.
You can do that.
You guys can sit and do that.
Also, we just like read out bits, and I mean, and it's
you know
that game Ex Libris where you try and write the first line of books.
We love it.
I think P.G. Woodhouse is the only one that you can't do. Like, no one can impersonate P.G. Woodhouse.
Better than P.G.
Woodhouse. But yeah, no one can do it better than him. Like, it's completely impossible.
You would try, and you'd write sort of the clunkiest line, and then it's something like, it was an autumn day.
Well, listen to this, for example.
Magic.
This is so classic. Jeeves placed the sizzling eggs and bee on the breakfast table, and Reginald, Kipper, Herring and I, licking the lips, squared our elbows and got down to it. Like, you're right, you couldn't.
It's magic.
You couldn't beat that. So my mum, from one of my birthdays a few years ago, my grandpa was a massive P.G. Wodehouse fan. In fact, when I knew I wanted to be a journalist, I wrote a letter to him when I was like a teenager.
You wrote a letter to P.G. Wodehouse?
No, to my grandpa. Oh. Saying like, my mum wrote a letter to P.G. Wodehouse and she's got it. She's still got a letter, a reply that she carries about in her handbag everywhere with her. And it's like, mum, that should be like in a sort of safe place. And she wrote to him when she was a teenager and he wrote back all about his, I think he had Pekingese dogs. And did he even have chickens? He was in New York by then. Anyway, she just got this letter from him. But I wrote to my grandpa saying, I want to be a writer, because he was a writer. What should I do? And he said, read everything by P.G. Wodehouse. And so we've always had massive piles of these really lovely old, like, Penguin classic version. Anyway, the other day, a couple of years ago, my mum had a clear out. And so I've got obviously some more modern ones, but I've got old ones as well. And they're just so wonderful.
Oh, because these lovely old... That's Jeeves in the Offing. And
Jeeves
it's
in the Offing.
I'm assuming.
When would that have been published? I'm thinking 70s, maybe. Oh no, first published in 1960. Jeeves. So this would be. Oh, this was an 80s one. The ones I love most of all, though, are the Emsworth Blandings ones.
You're a Blandings girl.
I'm a Blandings girl because of Lord M. I think because of Clarence and the pig, and you know the mishaps that go on.
When people were sick at Tatler, we would send them pyjamas and a complete set of P.G. Wodehouse to cheer them up.
I was never sick, because I don't remember this.
No, well, you were clearly never ill for long enough.
You
but
were
I think,
too healthy.
I think David got sick once, and he was home for a couple of weeks, so he sent him posh pyjamas and complete P.G. Wodehouse to cheer him up.
What? I should have been sick. That's so lovely.
Can we have some sort of freelance alliance where we...
Isn't that amazing? God, that's such a funny thing to do. I love it. Yeah, there's just... You're right about that thing of... I normally have... In fact, these are all... Yeah... bedside table ones, have a stack of them on your bedside table and then you can just basically pick it up. Doesn't really matter where you start reading, to be honest, because probably we've all read all of these before and you just pick up and you're straight into...
And every story sort of has the same beats, but I think he's the only writer that can almost write the same story
absolutely
every time and you still love it and you're in it.
Yeah.
And I do often think, I want to live in a universe where no matter how bad things get, before your evening repast, there is always, you know, cocktails and sort of things to nibble. But there's, you know, the little savoury things are as important.
Ideally made by Stephen Fry. That would be good, wouldn't
it? It's also we mentioned names earlier. It's also, you know, it's very hard, I think, to beat P.G. Wodehouse and the names of characters. He's just, they make me laugh so much. He's brilliant. Yeah, from Bertie down, really. Aunt, all those aunts. No, I can't think of any of the names, but anyway.
But there is something about the scrapes and sort of no matter how dreadful your day is, you're like, oh, well, you know, he just... he lost all his money at gambling, but he can still go to his club and, you know, have a big breakfast.
Yeah.
And he'll get carried along and sorted out. And at least he's not a dreadful fellow who likes newts.
Or have a, you know, hangover cure made by Jeeves. Or, you know, I love it when Bertie always needs one of those egg yolks.
Actually,
and Tabasco-y
I think I stole
concoctions.
A bit of it in Insatiable, and I think it missed the final edit because it was a bit dramatic. But there's Violet Has a Hangover, where I think I lifted it from. There's a I referred to the
Bullseye. It's just the
hangover itself is described in a way where I think she quotes P.G. Wodehouse and says,
"So
it's
good." Yeah, because Bertie
has the tomato juice with the raw egg and the Tabasco.
Yeah, and Bertie, you know, obviously often wakes up suffering, and Jeeves shimmers in quite often with this thing and puts it down, and then Bertie...
See, that would make a hangover okay,
Bertie,
wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. If you had your valet shimmering in. Yeah. And then Bertie bounces out of bed and goes straight to his club and sort of gets back on it. It's just so brilliant. Yeah, he is very, very excellent. Again, sort of no evil characters, you know, the old schemer, but nobody really bad.
Has there ever been a hangover book?
What can I just say about Standard Deviation?
Yeah.
Reading it, they drink so much. You know, and these
unlike
are, but these are like normal kind of adults in middle age.
It's like, oh, let's get half a bottle of wine out of the fridge. It's like masses of martinis all the time.
It's like, how do you operate? He's going to work every morning. That's what I didn't get. I was like, wow.
Cooking these really lavish, beautiful, thoughtful meals. And I'd love, you know, have that many drinks before. I'd be like, sorry, we're having toast.
Yeah. Scrambled eggs.
I was quite interested by the amount of booze they're drinking.
But that's why... Did we talk about this with Jilly Cooper or that the fantasy of just how boozy it is,
yeah,
and how you just start drinking at lunchtime and yeah, just carry on, and everyone does it at least several times a week,
yeah,
and no one ever seems to say, actually,
I'm never crying on a Wednesday, which is what happens to me if I've drunk three nights in a row, you know.
Oh, and sometimes they give up, or I think there's it might be in Tenders and Night where Dick is actually an alcoholic, but he stops. He only drinks wine. He stops Fine, drinking spirits, and that's a major concession.
Tipped over into yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
No. Very it's good observation. I just don't remember that.
I think there is a book in Literary Hangovers, and I think we should get together and compile it.
Yes.
Yeah. With cures, suggestions, helpful tips. Yeah, actually.
Well, it could be kind of a two-part book. It could be like amazing literary drunken moments, like kind of marathons of drinking, followed by literary hangovers, followed by cures.
Yeah.
Huge thanks to Sophia. If you haven't read her yet, binge her backlist. It's full of joy. Her latest, Did You Miss Me, is Woman in Holmes Comedy Novel of the Year. It's the story of Nell and how unexpected circumstances lead her back to her first love. But what's she going to do about her nice but boring boyfriend and the fact that her mother is embarking upon a fling with an Italian stallion? Hugely funny and fun. It's the perfect thing to curl up with and ease your Boxing Day hangover. You can follow us at YBooked on social media, look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends, and thank you so much to everyone who has left a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and their new favourite book. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Sophia at acast.com/booked and check out her selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. We'll be back next week. For now, I leave you with this from David's diaries. I haven't the slightest idea how to change people, but still I keep a long list of prospective candidates just in case I should ever figure it out. See you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.